What's going on, guys? Welcome to another episode of Healthspan Academy. I'm your host, Craig Shearhart, and today we have something a little different for you. We've got a couple of lost episodes. There was a couple episodes that we recorded earlier in the year that didn't pan out, some network issues that we had, but there was still some really good stuff there that I wanted to share with you guys. The first of these two was an interview that Kyle and I did with Dr. Laura Brown prior to the interview that we had with her for episode 16. So we chatted about her book a little bit, gut health and some nutrition, and it was a really good chat. So have a listen. Yeah, I wanted to circle back to the functional aspect of this, because, you know, as a functional sort of coach is my sort of traditional discipline. I see functional medicine, I don't know which is the extension of the other, but functional medicine and functional fitness, I just feel like they mesh really well together and kind of same principles. And a big principle in functional is thinking like from an ancestral perspective. So kind of circling back to the diet, you mentioned the Paleolithic sort of strategy throughout that. And I personally find that to be really beneficial in my own personal health. I'm wondering, do you think that's one of the first key steps that most people would benefit from? And that's kind of part one. And number two, are there people that don't respond well to a Paleolithic diet physiologically? And how do you tackle
really
that?
There's really good questions there, Craig. Because when we find things that work for ourselves, sometimes we feel like, oh, this has got to be great for everyone because we're feeling so awesome.
Exactly.
We want everybody to feel awesome. We want our friends to feel awesome. But what I've found over the years is that there's no one right diet for everyone. And there's no one right diet for everyone their whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've looked at a lot of different diets. And I talk about this in one of the chapters specifically in my book, because you look at all the different diets because you think, oh, this has got to be it. And then you get people coming in asking about this and asking about that. And your mind can just be spinning from all the different things people can be sensitive to, right? And so it's just appreciating people's own experiences and appreciating that, you know, what's right for you may not be right for somebody else. However, it's great to share what's right, you know, what's working for you, because, you know, maybe that is exactly what somebody else would feel super on. When it comes to the Paleolithic and ancestral diets, these are working in many regards, because it's just getting all the processed and packaged food, which our body just doesn't know how to digest, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting that out of there and getting us back to our whole foods, which is critical. But we find that, and I find this in clinic too, typically, and there was the book Eat Right for Your Blood Type, and I mentioned this in the book. And then there's also the FODMAP diet. There's things like, where do you go? But the blood types, often I find the O blood types do really well with the meat-based diet.
Mm.
They like meat, and they do really, really well with it. But then you get to people who are more A type, or, you know, they don't do so well with as a lot of meat. Maybe they eat a little bit of it, but you would find more vegans and vegetarians with A blood types. And then you have B blood types and AB blood types. And the B blood types, you know, they typically are your pesco vegetarians or your pesco Mediterranean kind of, you know, they kind of fringe on, oh, I'll eat a little bit of meat. Maybe I'll have it once or twice a month, you know, that type of thing. And, you know, it's just finding what's right. And I know you guys were asking, about gluten too. It's like, oh, we thought lots of people have gluten sensitivities, and you know, I do a lot with gluten, and I have a lot of people come in my office with gut issues. And of course, I'm seeing the percentage of my patients, like, more than the 70% are coming in with gluten stuff. I would say probably I see 95% of my people. Wow. You know, I'm like, oh, and then the gluten free is really helpful, or we're doing the testing and that. But I do see a handful that aren't. They're fine with it, as long as it's within them. And the science tells us that if we were to test everybody, about 70% would have a gluten sensitivity. Okay. But the people that are doing well and don't have an issue with it probably aren't coming in to see me, right? They're doing all right.
True.
But we know that nobody has the enzymes to break down the gluten, and that it does cause inflammation. It does cause irritability in the gut lining. And most people would heal within 20 minutes. But some people, it takes up to 5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's time for the next meal. And you're doing that over and over again over a course of a lifetime. And then you throw in stress, and you throw in bugs that shouldn't be in there, or parasites and things like that. And the gut gets to be a mess. If your gut is a mess, and you think of what I just said a minute ago about gluten bothering your, irritating and inflaming, then of course we're going to take it out anyways, right? Because it's just too difficult.
Mm-hmm.
It's, so we're taking those triggers out. Maybe they can reintroduce it again later, but they need a break. They need a break from it. And this is where the Paleolithic diet, looking at the ancestral side of things, is so critical, because it's pretty much brain free in a lot of regards.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're saying, and then some people are okay with the legumes and the beans, others not. Some people are okay with the dairy, others not. So just kind of finding the right thing. And because there's so many nuances, I'll often do the food sensitivity screening just to see where we're at. And then we can repeat it. Like once you get your gut fixed or balanced, probably a better word, in a happier place, then you may be able to tolerate some other foods. And it can take years to be able to reintroduce stuff. And I speak that from my own experience. And then sometimes it's quantity, right? It's like, I can handle a little bit of this now and then, but if I get too much, right, then things start to fire up again.
For sure. Yeah. And I love that about your book. And I think that's such a great point, that there's so much individuality, because like a lot of times you get a book and it's like, this is the method, right? And I think this is like, this worked for this author. This is great. And this is now everybody's solution. And I think that's kind of the vibe I get when I've read a bunch of books on nutrition. Most recently I've read The Carnivore Code I don't want to turn this into bashing Dr. Saladino, but he does take that stance. And it's very much this is kind of the way. And one of the points he makes is about vegetables. And I know you talk about the value in vegetables, and I believe there's much value in vegetables, but there's a little bit of debate that is, I think, stemmed from that book. Mostly is that there's an upper limit and there's actually a level of vegetable toxicity. What are your thoughts on that? Is that, again, just something that's very person specific, or can we go overboard on the vegetables in general?
I had a laugh when you asked that question, because I love vegetables. We have this awesome garden. My son has his master's in agriculture, so he plants this beautiful garden. And I mean, I've been eating lettuce that we planted last fall, but it started to come back to me than the greenhouses and stuff this, in March. So I'm eating garden lettuce in March, and I'm already eating kale and stuff out of the garden. And I basically, love my veggies. But I eat meat too. I love meat. I have, I always say I'm not pro vegan, but I'm pro vegetable. Mm-hmm. But there are times when, yes, I can have too much kale, it does happen. But too much of anything isn't good for us. Mm-hmm. It's about balance, right? And finding that balance for you. And what I say to people, we can eat upwards towards like 10 cups of veggies a day. Okay. That's a lot of vegetables. That's a lot. Most people, there's some people, like I know some people, it's just like, I get salad. I put lettuce and tomato on my hamburger. And then I know other people that take the lettuce and tomato off because they are, they do not want a vegetable in sight. So there's extremes that go on about this, but I do find that because of the phytochemicals that are packed in plants, and plants are put here to serve us, they're put here to heal us. They are really, they have personalities, and they offer us so, so much, and we have to use them wisely, and they can really be our medicine. You have to think our herbal medicines are made out of plants. Many of the prescription medications are taking a constituent that worked out of the plant, and now, making a pharmaceutical constituent synthetically that matches that chemical component.
Mm-hmm.
But it came from a plant, the wisdom of plant. Mm-hmm. And this blows, this blows me away. I love this topic. So again, there is a limit. We need, we need about 30 grams of fiber in a day, and most people get about 5. A lot of our fiber is coming from plants.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And this is important for many different reasons, right? We've got to feed our microbiome. We've got to be able to have soluble and insoluble fiber to make a good stool, right? This type of thing. But if you're eating one cup of veggies in a day, don't go and try to eat 10 tomorrow. I mean, no, like maybe have 2. Mm-hmm. And then in the wintertime, in our cold Canadian winters, don't go and eat a bunch of raw salads, because it's too much for our bodies to digest. It's just not good. So we're eating more cooked and slow cooked kind of vegetables and root vegetables. I mean, we eat for the season as well.
Sure.
right? So in the wintertime, we're eating more of those root veggies, more of the hearty stuff that take longer to cook. And then I find in the spring, it's, you know, making sure we get a little bit of berries and lots of those greens that are popping up, dandelion greens and asparagus and mint and all of those early greens to help us detoxify and lighten up from the winter. And then that kind of comes into the season of, you know, lots of lettuces and green leafies, dark green leafies, and eating those, you know. And then, you know, again, as we're rolling into the fall, it's again more of those hearty things, the pumpkins, the squashes, and mm-hmm. things like that. Does that mean you can't eat a little bit of squash right now? No, you're probably eating it, you know, in less quantity. But it is important to eat with the season. I mean, we are part of nature and we eat within where we're living is so important. So eating locally is not just about, you know, not transporting the food. It's also about being connected to, you know, where we are.
It's a great point. Yeah, I love that answer. And I think like, and I don't want to keep beating the dead horse, but I think like I found value in when I was reading the Carnivore Code, because he does cite papers throughout it. But like when you start, I mean, there's thousands of papers out there that are supporting the nutrient value of vegetables, and all of a sudden they're apparently wrong. I think that's kind of silly. So I think I agree that most of us probably could benefit from plants. And there might be a few select, I think, that, and maybe you can attest to that, that don't benefit from plants as much as others, or even non-plants for once in a while. I tried it out and didn't jive with me well, but I do want to talk a little bit about, I guess carnivore's step back, which should be keto. And then you mentioned keto, briefly in the book, and talk about the risk to the thyroid. I was wondering if you could expand on that a little bit. Or the thought of going cyclical keto. I've found personal good success with that, just doing very low carb during the week and then replenishing with a few more vegetables and fruits on the weekend. Talk maybe a little bit about how that does strain the thyroid and maybe how we can sort of mitigate that.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because this takes me back to when I was competing in my fitness competitions when I was, 15 and 16. And I was doing, I would do cyclical diets throughout the week and it would be, no carb. I think I had carbs on 2 days, but the other days were zero carbs. And it was also zero fat then too. And that wasn't, in hindsight, all that healthy from that perspective, but it's what we knew then. And it's what we did. And then when we take in a carbohydrate, and for every carbohydrate molecule, it's going to attach 4 molecules of water to it. So as you pull the carbohydrates and you burn that out of your muscle, you're also going to squeeze the water out of the body as well. That's why you go pee so much while you're on the keto diet, because you have no carb to hold on to it. So it's acting, and then if you're putting in good fluids, you're actually flushing the body, right? And if you're calorie depriving or the body is metabolically primed, and those two things can be different, you will start to lose weight on the keto. And I find it also helps reset the insulin sensitivity, which is, to do with carb storage and burning and this type of thing. And this is why the keto diet is so helpful for people who have become, they're non-insulin sensitive. Their insulin sensitivity has gone away and they're on, their blood sugar starting to rise and not able to manage their blood sugars. We're seeing people with PCOS. We're seeing people with, hormonal imbalance, this type of thing. And the keto diet can be really, really helpful. And keto is like, next to no carbs. But we know when there's next to no carbs for an extended length of time, and I would say beyond 4 or 5 months, then we start to have issues long-term, potentially with the thyroid. And the thyroid needs about 50 grams of carbs a day. And that's not much if you think about it. If you have a few vegetables, you're going to get some carbs. And it doesn't have to be starchy carbs. It can just, carbs come from a lot of different things. People sometimes think they're eating keto if they're not doing any grains or potatoes, for example. But you're getting carbs from your vegetables. I mean, I remember counting how many carbs are in a green bean, for goodness sake. So, I mean, you're getting things from, from different places. When I do suggestions, I usually say, don't worry about the carbs in the vegetables. Let's count the carbs in fruit, nuts and seeds, beans and lentils, starchy vegetables, and any of the grains. Let's look at those as our carbs and let's, balance according to that. And then, you know, getting whatever vegetables, you know, if they're eating one cup, let's try to get 2 cups of vegetables. And that's your green. It's like your brassicas, like your cabbage-based family, your leafy greens, and then maybe like zucchini and celery and onions and garlic. And I find that, I do that and then layer in the food sensitivities. It seems to work well. And then make sure that people are getting the proper amount of protein. I mean, our body needs protein. It's a basic DNA building block. Again, it comes back to balance. It's not that any one of the carb, fat, or protein is bad. It's where is the body at? What does the body need right now? What's the microbiome doing? Because we're feeding really our microbiome more than we're feeding ourselves. So what is it doing for it?
Awesome. Great answer. It's always great chatting with Laura. She's such a wealth of info. Hope you guys enjoyed that. Next clip we have I want to share with you was with Dr. Anthony Incognito, who's an expert in neurocardiovascular physiology. We chatted about some really cool developments in ischemic reconditioning, overtraining, and some really cool recovery metrics. Check it out. Cool. Good to see you again. So I want to start with ischemic preconditioning. That seems to be what you've done most of your work in. And it's still, I feel like, kind of a relatively new topic, or at least unfamiliar to a lot of people. So let's talk about how that technology sort of began, your role in that, and some of the theory behind it.
Yeah, for sure. I guess it was first uncovered. Well, I guess what it is would be inducing like ischemic bouts. So what that would mean is like stopping blood flow to an area of the body temporarily, so not too long that you'll actually damage that area, but just long enough that you stress it out a little bit. So in a way, it's kind of like exercise. That's kind of what exercise is a stimulus for.
Right.
And when they call it ischemic, then preconditioning, essentially the idea is that you're conditioning that body part. And I'll explain later how it actually becomes the whole body in a way towards ischemic stress afterwards.
Right.
So an ischemic stress afterwards, most of the time it's understood as being like a heart attack or a stroke, but we do undergo like ischemic stressors even when we exercise. So some of this research where it was originally brought on clinically has started to cascade over into the exercise performance literature as well.
Yeah, let's talk about, well, some of your own findings, I guess. What are the results you're seeing with that? What are the kind of key parameters you've got to think about putting that into practice?
Yeah, for sure. So my work originally in that area was looking at how the muscle metabolic reflex can potentially be altered. What the muscle metabolic reflex is, basically when you start exercising, you get, well, muscle metabolite buildup in the muscle. And what ends up happening is that reflexively increases your blood pressure.
Right.
And you need that to sustain exercise at a certain level for a long period of time. Now, where that can become problematic is in cardiovascular conditions where this reflex could be on overdrive. So what I tried to originally look at is like, if I do an ischemic preconditioning bout, would this make the muscle that is going to be active during exercise almost like less anaerobic, so to speak? And so almost making it like more efficient to the exercise, and could it curb that reflex pathway?
Right.
And then it would have clinical implications more so. So that's how I first got involved in it. It actually wasn't necessarily the case to work that way. It didn't alter this reflex whatsoever.
So just so I understand. So you're talking about a system that, or a stimulus that would normally be anaerobic, like sprint, and make it more reliant on oxygen. Is that what you're saying?
Almost. Yeah. And you know what, I say almost because we're not actually really sure. But that was the idea. And I actually didn't necessarily do a sprint. I did kind of like, well, I just did something simple, like a hand grip exercise.
Okay.
Or you can imagine over time, you get like that burning in your forearm, like if you're doing rock climbing or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I just kept it to a simple stimulus just to test this reflex in a fairly isolated way.
Right.
So that was my hypothesis, because there's a lot of work in animal models where they produce some type of ischemic stress. And if they had been preconditioned before, lactic acid levels drop, the oxygen utilization becomes more efficient in the mitochondria, things like that. So this was my original hypothesis. I said maybe it could be applied to humans, but you know, humans aren't, you know, isolated animal model. So it didn't quite work that way, at least in the population I tested. I actually just tested young healthy individuals, right? Where we compensate very well. So that was my first exposure. That was actually my master's thesis.
Cool.
So that's kind of where it all started. Yeah. So from there, I actually focused a lot of my research on blood pressure control. So I moved away from ischemic preconditioning, but I always had this really strong interest in it. So naturally, I kept up with the literature, and I've kept up enough that I was able to publish two review articles on the topic, one being related to exercise performance.
Right.
So a very applicable outcome measure, not like this metaboreflex, something more applicable. And then another more recent one is I looked at how ischemic preconditioning could possibly be applied in COVID-19 to try to curb severe illness. Now, again, this is just reviewing literature. We don't actually have data on this.
Right.
What I did is I looked at how ischemic preconditioning was shown to work in other conditions where you might think there may be related pathologies to COVID-19, and see if, and just basically start the conversation essentially with this research paper to move it that way, to see if it's possible. Seems like a while to do research study, but I mean, that was just perfect amount of time. And so the component that I looked at was the autonomic nervous system, but I didn't use not a non-invasive measure like a heart rate variability or anything like that. We tried to go more invasive, more direct. And how we do that is by directly recording sympathetic nerves in humans. So that involves a technique called microneurography, where you're basically putting these little needle electrodes into your peripheral nerve. So, you know, you have these like very superficial nerves, like let's say in your elbow, you hit your funny bone, right? Yeah. So that's a nerve, and it has a bunch of stuff going through it. I mean, it's a nerve that goes to contract your muscles, to feel like tactile sensation, proprioception. But another, you know, bundle of nerves that runs through that whole big nerve are sympathetic fibers. And those sympathetic fibers, they're going to blood vessels, and they're contracting blood vessels when your blood pressure is too low. They're relaxing blood vessels by withdrawing their activity to make blood pressure kind of come back down if it's too high. So it's kind of sympathetic activity is always turned in this system. It's called muscle sympathetic nerve activity. It's a bit of a misnomer because it's not going to the muscle per se, it's going to the muscle blood vessels. So that was our index of autonomic function. This signal comes from the brainstem. It's a sympathetic drive. It's always turned on. So that might also be somewhat of a new topic, where it's not always the fight or flight system that the sympathetic system's meant or is portrayed to be, where it's only turned on when you're in an emergency. You do have this blood pressure control system that strongly relies on this basal sympathetic outflow. So that's kind of the measurement that I looked at, and we found that with overreaching, we could actually elevate this level of sympathetic activity, this measure, which has implications for cardiovascular control. As I mentioned, I don't want to get too in detail, but as I mentioned, if blood pressure is low relatively to what the body requires, blood pressure is low, you're going to drive sympathetic activity. If blood pressure is too high, you might shut it down. And then there's resetting over time. But whenever we see an increase in sympathetic activity, if you were to cascade this over to, let's say, a heart failure patient or a patient with hypertension, we see on average there, this exact measure, muscle sympathetic nerve activity, is much higher than the average healthy person. And what that could tell us is that it's possible that the blood pressure in that individual is not high enough. They could have high blood pressure, but relative to what they need, It might not be high enough that they're supplying enough blood flow and oxygen to all their tissues appropriately. So that's kind of how I see this, what I see this system as potentially signaling. If you see elevations in muscle sympathetic nerve activity, it probably means that something is being underperfused and the body's trying to compensate for it.
Right.
So with overreaching, it's possible that there's vascular dysfunction going on that is maybe sensed in some way and signaling for your body to try to raise blood pressure. And it's constantly having this fight using the sympathetic nervous system to do that. So this is kind of, again, very basic. It's not very applied, but that was kind of the mechanistic cardiovascular regulation that we studied with that.
So that change in pressure, do we know how, if that's leading? I mean, I think of like your sympathetic, parasympathetic measurement. The most basic thing I'm familiar with is heart rate variability.
Sure.
Is that pressure one of the factors leading to it? Do we know that? Or is it kind of chicken or egg thing? Or do you know how that's related? Has that been studied?
With heart rate
variability in terms of like the pressure that you're analyzing?
Yeah. So how I understand heart rate variability, it's like, well, I think almost because I know too much, I don't like it anymore.
Yeah,
I guess when you dig into stuff, you just kind of, you better understand assumptions that go along with measures, generally, right? So with heart rate variability is, I think it's modulated by blood pressure fluctuations. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of a reflex loop, just like the sympathetic system that I explained I was measuring. When blood pressure goes down, you increase sympathetic outflow. And the same idea, if blood pressure goes down, you actually increase heart rate. Okay, so that's kind of the reflex modulation that's there. And naturally, we have this blood pressure fluctuation at rest. Some people more than others, but naturally, we all have this blood pressure fluctuation. And if you are kind of a healthy individual and this reflex is well intact, then with every oscillation, you should see a reflexive change in your heart rate.
Right.
So if blood pressure transiently rises, not abnormally, just normally, then you should see a normal drop in your heart rate. Mm-hmm. Blood pressure will come back down naturally because it's a feedback system, and then you get this drive again to increase your heart rate. So then at rest, if someone's reflexes are really well intact and this reflex to drop heart rate, for example, is driven by the parasympathetic nervous system, which is why it's seen to, you know, potentially be an index of parasympathetic tone.
Mm-hmm.
So if this reflex is intact and it's the primary driver of heart rate, then you might see heart rate variability to be high.
Right.
If you were to pick an extreme example, not extreme, but to the other end of the spectrum, if you were to go for a run, you have a lot of other things going on now to influence your heart rate. It's not just your blood pressure fluctuations. Now your thought pattern of actually driving muscle activity, that's going to go towards increasing your heart rate. You have muscular activity itself. You're inflating your lungs more. There's
all those little things, eh?
All those little things. They're all like, and it's all the nervous system integrating this and telling your heart rate you have to beat more. And oftentimes it's a more sustained beat pattern in this case.
Right.
To the point where you maybe get to your max heart rate and there's no more fluctuation. You're just trying to survive, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. If you go to that end of the spectrum. So if you consider a spectrum like this, very rested versus very stressed, you could see, yes, heart rate variability will change in that it gets less. So more consistent beat intervals when you get more stressed, generally speaking.
Huh. That's interesting. So maybe this could be a rabbit hole conversation if we get into this, but maybe the new loop will be like a blood pressure variation measurement. Like, I don't know, to figure out how to, probably more invasive or a little more to, like, I don't know how they could jig that together, but, that's like, it's a better indicator, I think, of your overall state.
100%. And I just saw a paper come out. Well, I saw it yesterday, but I think it came out last week, but I think they surveyed or measured 8 million people or something over time. And they looked at their blood pressure variability, and this is getting them into the lab because you need beat-to-beat blood pressure measures. So I can talk to how we do that also. But in doing these measures, so it's more than just a blood pressure cuff where you take one, you know, it takes a whole minute just to get a reading.
Yeah.
This is every single time your heart beats, you look at
that dynamic signal. Yeah.
Exactly. Cool. And they actually were seeing that, or they showed that the risk of dementia in later life was more linked to the blood pressure variability than the actual average level of blood pressure.
That's fascinating.
It's pretty cool. Yeah.
And,
so,
all ties back into sleep and recovery, right? If you think of they've definitely linked dementia to sleep issues, and that if you're not fully recovering, you're not getting that deep sleep. That's fascinating. That's very cool.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. A very integrative process, and if you need 8 million people to show an effect, I don't know how strong of it is on its own,
right?
Because you're going to be powered quite a bit with 8 million people, but it does show a nice big sample of a population,
right?
With large, so the idea here is when you have large blood pressure variability, it's almost like that reflex system that, and I say this reflex system, I'll be specific for those that want to know, the barrel reflex system. Mm-hmm. It's almost like it's taken too long to adjust or adapt to a pressure rise. So your blood pressure is rising. You should drop your heart rate now, but you don't. It keeps rising a little bit more than the average person.
Right.
And then your heart rate will drop. And then finally it will come down. And then can you activate your heart rate fast enough to get it back up? Maybe not. And naturally you have more of these oscillatory patterns. How that affects vascular function long-term in the brain, that's, an active area of research now.
Hmm. That's interesting. So your diversity of control, I guess, of your cardiovascular system, or your, I guess, dynamic control is that big factor, I guess, leading into it, is what the theory is leading to at this point.
100%. Yeah, it's a huge factor, and it would be the optimal measure, as you mentioned, measuring dynamic blood pressure patterns beat to beat.
Right.
But it's very invasive if you were to do it long term.
Yeah.
Usually you have to put, a catheter up an artery. So you need an anesthesiologist to do that. It's not really done.
Yeah.
How we do that in the lab, though, is we actually just use a finger cuff. So we put a little cuff around the finger, and it uses a technology that will inflate and measure pressure on time with your heartbeat.
Huh.
Right. So even if your heart rate changes, it has algorithms to recognize that and take the pressure at every beat, and it's pretty accurate. It's almost exactly aligned with intra arterial lines. So
cool.
It's very good to measure oscillatory pressure. Now, it's not good at telling you what your mean pressure is, your average blood pressure, because this is at the finger. And if your finger's cold, if it's hot, the blood vessels are smaller, so they're not going to tell you the whole story.
If all you're looking for is the change, that's
it's a good
indicator. Yeah. Just wait till the biohackers get a hold of this. I'm sure they're going to get more. Cool. Let's talk about your more recent work and some of the applications. You talked about some of the conditioning and its relation to COVID, kind of that stress, and how talk about that relationship and what you found.
Yeah. So that was kind of a review paper that I looked at. How I decided to go about this was I knew that there were anti-inflammatory properties of ischemic preconditioning, unrelated to the exercise world. Usually, I think some exercise studies now are starting to look at inflammatory markers. I think one recent one showed that after a marathon run, I don't want to get off topic, but I think it's related. After a marathon run, I think there's a lower rise in your inflammatory mediators. You can imagine a marathon, Ironman, any of these long distance things, they're fairly inflammatory to the body.
Sure. That's almost like a hybrid of chronic. You're almost like bordering on chronic versus acute inflammation at that point. I feel like, is that we'd see physiologically?
In any exercise setting, you will have an acute inflammatory response. So, but then when you're thinking long-term exercise, basically these inflammatory mediators can just become more and more augmented,
right?
At the same exercise intensity. So if you were to run at a marathon pace for 2 minutes, nothing's going to happen.
Yeah.
If you were to do like really heavy weight training for 2 minutes, you might actually get an inflammatory
thing. It's just that prolonged response. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's like intensity or duration, a combination of those things can lead to more or less muscle damage, even prolonged heart stretch when you're looking at cardiovascular exercise. And all this stuff can lead to inflammatory responses. And ischemic preconditioning just recently was shown to, before a marathon, so immediately before, it can curb some of those inflammatory mediators. So possibly in some way protecting the body against some of this damage, whatever that may be. I'm speaking generally because I think it's right now just understood generally anyway.
So that was kind of the premise that led to your work.
Yeah, that actually was just a fun tidbit I just threw in there. Fair enough. But yeah, it is related though, because the reason why they would even look at that in the first place is because there were indications that ischemic preconditioning could be anti-inflammatory from like animal models, other disease cohorts and things like that. So because of that, a lot of the time ischemic preconditioning was first developed to be applied before a surgery. And why a surgery is because oftentimes a surgery, you have to cut off blood flow to a certain organ, and that could be in and of itself damaging to the organ. In a way, it also causes inflammation,
right?
But so that's why this is like, it's direct. It's like ischemia, preconditioning, and what's the stress? Ischemia. It's like, okay, with that work, we can see that the levels of inflammation in patients can come down, whether it be in the tissue level or whether it be systemically in the bloodstream. It's a combination of work. It's also highly variable depending on the patient group and all this stuff, the anesthetic used for surgery. There's lots of the age of the patients. But regardless, there's indications that in perfect circumstances, you can curb inflammatory markers of ischemic damage,
right?
If you're in surgery. So there naturally, I think that led to, okay, what about other types of inflammatory stressors like a septic stress? Septic stress is when it's just kind of a generic, surge of inflammatory mediators. It's sometimes thrown on by infection, sometimes by a gut dysbiosis if it's very severe, like a colitis or something like that. It's a very generic term for just mass levels of systemic inflammation, and there's specific clinical measures for that. So in animal models, they can induce sepsis and test ischemic preconditioning. And it's always been shown in animal models to reduce the inflammatory stress of a septic type situation. In the same way, in COVID-19, you have this inflammatory stress that starts at the lung. And if it gets so bad in the severe cases, you can actually promote a systemic inflammatory infarct, where now the peripheral inflammation can actually start causing damage to multiple organ systems.
Right.
So that's where you can have, cognitive or brain issues, neurological issues with COVID-19. You can have heart inflammation or heart damage. You can have kidney failure, and you basically multiple organ failure in the most severe cases. And it's all caused by this septic status.
So that's like is that what we're talking about when we talk about like long haul COVID?
Yeah, long haul
brain fog. It's just basically other parts of the body being impacted beyond the lungs. Is that what we're talking about here?
We're talking right now. It's related. Right now, I'm talking about acute COVID, like you're going to the hospital.
Gotcha.
Okay. Right, you're going to the hospital because you can't breathe very well, and oftentimes, what the more organs affected is very linked to the level of inflammation in the body, and that's most linked to mortality outcomes.
Right.
So basically, the idea that I was presenting in my review was to see if we were to induce an ischemic preconditioning in a patient that contracted COVID, or even before they contracted COVID, not that they would know. So if you did it early enough, could you curb some of these extreme inflammatory responses? That was the idea. Because of the work in animal models, some work largely in surgery when it comes to human participants. But that was the general idea. So that's kind of where that idea led. And I think it was received fairly well, not well enough that we're using it or to start a trial. But I think in future cases of pneumonia or things like that, hopefully that started the conversation to maybe try to use non-pharmacological methods to, you know, because the body is powerful in and of itself. It's, if it's stimulated well, it doesn't always need a drug to target something. So that was the idea. And I think that hopefully started the conversation. Now, and then briefly to long COVID, whenever you have a sustained level of high inflammation in the body, it kind of almost links to overtraining in a way, where you can have these prolonged effects even after the inflammation and the stress is not right in front of the body anymore.
So that could potentially sort of beat it to the punch by hitting that precondition. It's like decrease your chances of getting long-term COVID. Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
Cool. That's awesome, man. That's fascinating.
That's pretty cool. Yeah.
I'm curious to hear where that goes. So there you have it, guys. That is our Lost Episode series. Hope you got some value out of these two discussions. It was a great chat, and I just thought it would be good to put it out there for you. Thanks so much for supporting this channel. This is our first year that we've existed, and every little subscription, every like, every listen to the episodes helps us a great deal. So thanks for supporting us. We're really excited about some of the content we have for you coming up in the new year. Some more really solid athletes, some really intelligent people in the world of biohacking and longevity. So we're looking forward to bring that to you. And thanks again for your support. Have yourself a safe and happy new year, and we'll see you next time on HealthSpan Academy.